Skip, you say it's so easy, you do it. Hit your head on the rim. If you can't do that, shut up, Cam. That argument is obviously ASA 9, ASA 10, ASA 11. I'm relentless. Can you feel this? I'm going all in. It's time to cash in. One moment in time. Let's get at this. Be tremendous. Relentless. I'm relentless. Here we go. This is the Skip Bayless Show, episode 105. This, as always, is the undisputed everything I cannot share with you during the 2.5 hour debate show that is undisputed. Today, I will fire back at Cam Newton. Today, I'll fire back at my brother Lil Wayne for shaming me for having never heard of, never experienced the candy called Now and Laters. Today, I will give you my final four picks whether you want to hear them or not, while guaranteeing you they are almost certainly laughably wrong. That's why they call it madness, all you pool fools out there. And today, I will answer a number of your probing, provocative questions concerning my all-out Dallas Cowboys and what one sports event I got the most nervous before. And finally, whether I actually ran last Sunday's LA Marathon out here in Los Angeles. But first up, as always, it is not to be skipped. So, the other day, I happened to stumble upon a clip from Cam Newton's podcast. A clip in which Cam blasted me. I'm pretty sure I'm blasted more than anyone in sports media, because I'm pretty sure my name is the ultimate internet clickbait. I rarely respond, as you know, but because I respect Cam Newton's stature, the MVP he won 2015, the Super Bowl he played in following that season, I certainly take Cam Newton seriously enough to merit a response. I've always liked Cam, liked his style, loved how he dared to be different at a position that was supposed to be so Tom Brady and so Peyton Manning. And for the record, while Cam was blasting me on his podcast, he did slip in, and I like Skip. I like Cam. And just for the record, going back two football seasons ago, I reached out to Cam through a mutual friend asking him to come to LA for whatever he wanted, 3, 4, 5 days, a full week, to be on Undisputed as a guest commentator. My point to him through the friend was, Cam has the personality, the charisma, the gift of gab required to succeed in the media business, as you can see on his podcast. So why not come to LA and experience live TV for 2.5 hours a day for maybe 5 straight days, a full week, seeing if he liked it. You could also see if it liked him. I was told that Cam had family commitments the week that we targeted, couldn't make it. We tried again a couple times, just didn't click, didn't work. I regret that. But that was then, this is now. On Undisputed, as you probably know, the morning after Anthony Edwards' chase down block that saved the game against Indiana, I called it the easiest block ever. A dad block, as in dad on 8-year-old kid. I called it killing a gnat with a sledgehammer, because that's exactly what it was. Now, please understand this about me. I despise the term hot take. A hot take suggests to me that you racked your brain to come up with some shocking, against the grain, contrarian opinion that will make people run to their phone or their computer and type, "How can you say that?" While perhaps making you trend on Twitter for a while for an opinion that you don't remotely believe. That's straight shock jock to me. That's hot take. That's contrarian. And I'm not a contrarian. I'm a truth teller. Or at least I try with all my heart and soul to be. Hot takes are not remotely who I am. I very simply say what I see. I watch very closely. It feels like every game, every night, as my wife Ernestine unfortunately will tell you. And I say what I see. It comes right out of my heart and my soul. I don't know, maybe it even comes from my God voice, as I call it, my intuition, my deepest instinct, telling me to say that. And that is often a point of view that maybe few, if any, see, few, if any, say. If I have any gift, that's my gift. But trust me, from the bottom of my heart, bottom of my soul, I believe every last word I say on TV with every bit of my heart and soul. On Twitter during games, I'm giving it to you raw in real time. On Undisputed, at least I've been able to sleep on it, albeit for maybe 4 hours a night. I've been able to research it. I've been able to think it completely through for an hour on the treadmill. And while I hit the shower, and then while I hit the road into the Fox studios where I sit as we speak. So this is what I saw on Ant-Man's Chase Down Block. Remember, he had just missed the overtime clinching free throw at the other end of the floor. And I love this about this kid. He was so enraged at himself that he took off running full speed, bat out of hell, to redeem himself at the other end of the floor. Meanwhile, Aaron Nesmith from my school, Vanderbilt University, once the 16th pick in the draft by the Boston Celtics, was dribbling the ball up court and trying fairly frantically to decide 5-4-3-2-1 as the clock ticked down to nothing, trying to decide how much time he had before the game ended and he needed to shoot the basketball. So he passed up the three-point line. So no three to win the game. Could have tried that. Now he's passing into that mid-range. Going to pull up and shoot it, maybe off the glass. No, that didn't work. And I think for a split second, he decided he's going to go for broke and go for the dunk. Maybe the and one, you never know. Or at worst, the two free throws to tie. Aaron Nesmith is 6'6" tall. And yet, here out of the corner of his eye comes wily little Mike Conley Jr., who crossed Neesmith's path and effectively cut Aaron Neesmith off at the pass. He forced Aaron to slow just for an instant and rethink his path just for a split set. We're talking about split seconds here. You can see it if you watch it closely. That gave Ant-Man an extra split second to catch up. Now, all of this sequence reminded me of, you'll certainly remember this, the most famous chase down block ever, Game 7 at Golden State. LeBron James, LeBron bleepin' James, 6 foot 6 inch Andre Iguodala, was clearly thinking about trying to dunk the basketball. But guess what? J.R. Smith cut across his path, cut right across it, headed him off at the pass, made Iggy hesitate just for a split second and lose momentum. This gave LeBron an extra split second to catch up. As Iggy was finally relegated to trying to shoot a layup? Really, just a layup? Off rhythm, off momentum, layup. A layup which LeBron obviously was able to block sensationally, historically. As LeBron and Kyrie's Cavs stormed back from 3-1 down to win Game 7 at Golden State. That's why I called that block, that epic block, that historic block, a bicycle built for two, because J.R. Smith definitely deserved an assist for slowing Iggy just enough and messing up his dunk momentum. Same for Mike Conley on Aaron Neesmith. Conley slowed him down and messed up his dunk momentum. And Aaron Neesmith finally opted for just trying to lay the ball up to tie the game. Now, 6 foot 9 inch Jaden McDaniels loomed above Neesmith. I'm pretty sure that McDaniels would have blocked Neesmith's layup attempt also, if not for that enraged Ant-Man skyrocketing above him, over him, through him, to easily swat the layup attempt by Aaron Neesmith. He sledgehammered the Gnat. He dad-blocked Aaron Neesmith. Now, as I said repeatedly on live TV on Undisputed, I loved the fact that Anthony Edwards did not hang his head the way so many players would in a similar circumstance after missing that free throw. No, he didn't pout. He didn't sulk. He didn't hang back. Watch what was about to transpire. No, he went into a dead sprint to redeem himself. Go, Ant-Man, go. He plays with great rage, always in attack mode. As John Collins the other night experienced right in his face, that Ant-Man dunk that sent John Collins right out of the game into the locker room to be evaluated for a concussion. That Jordan-esque intangible, that intangible alone is what is starting to make Ant-Man at age 22, as he finishes his fourth year in the NBA, starting to make him special. Starting is the operative word. But thanks to Mike Conley, Aaron Nesmith just decided, I can't dunk it. I'm out of rhythm. And that's why that became as easy a block as you will ever see, ever see. Now, if Aaron Nesmith from Vanderbilt University had kept his rhythm and momentum and had just decided full on to take dead aim at the rim and go up and try to slam it at the buzzer, and Ant-Man had met him in midair, hand on ball, all ball, and rejected that dunk attempt, basically body bagged Aaron Nesmith in midair, now we're talking epic. Now we can venture into all-time great territory. But that didn't happen. Aaron Smith and Nesmith looked lost to me. He just tried to lay it up as a last resort. And his gnat of a layup got sledgehammered by a rocket-launched, enraged Ant-Man. So, now back to Cam Newton, who said of me on his podcast, "Skip, you say it's so easy, you do it. Hit your head on the rim. If you can't do that, shut up and keep your irrelevant thoughts to yourself," said Cam about me on his podcast. I'll start with this, Cam. That's where you want to go. Let's see you hit your head on the rim. And if you can't, because I don't think you can, then you should shut up. That's your logic. I'll use it back on you. Cam, that argument is obviously as a 9, as a 10, as a 11, as a 23 in honor of the GOAT, Michael Jeffrey Jordan. Cam, I will bet you that dozens of NBA players are capable of getting a running start and, if they so chose, hitting their head on the rim. Not asking them to try it, wouldn't be the smartest thing to try, but I will bet you they are capable of doing just that. Heck, little Mac McClung, winner of the last two NBA dunk contests, All-Star Weekend dunk contests, Mac McClung was having to duck during his contest dunks to keep from hitting his head on the rim, Cam Newton. Mac McClung? Can't even make an NBA roster, Mac McClung. The dunk contest has come to that. So, Cam, I ask you, how many coaches and coordinators did you have in high school and junior college and college, Florida and Auburn, Blinn, pro football, Carolina, New England? How many did you have who never even played in the NFL? Why'd you even listen to them? I don't know, maybe you didn't. You played for the great Bill Belichick. He played Division III lacrosse at Wesleyan, Division III lacrosse. Did you tell him to shut up and keep his irrelevant opinions to himself? Did you ever turn around and say, "Bill, let me see you throw it 60 yards, and then I'll listen to you"? How about Howie Roseman of the Philadelphia Eagles? He's at it again. Saquon, Devin White, Looks like he's about to rebuild another potential Super Bowl team that's better than my Dallas Cowboys. Howie Roseman didn't even play high school football, Cam. Would you tell him to just shut up and go home because he has no idea what he's doing? So, Cam, should you and I maybe have a three-point shooting contest? And if I win, then you can never, ever speak publicly again about anyone's ability to shoot a basketball. I seriously do not think you could beat me in a three-point horse contest. I don't think you could beat me. If you want to try, let's go. I'm game. Tell me when and where. I'll be there. But that's not my point. My point is I don't need to be able to hit my head on the rim to call that as easy a block as I have ever seen, you will ever see. Cam, I'm not one to ooh and ah and leap, so to speak, to conclusions on Twitter, X, Twitter, whatever you want to call it, trying to call something the greatest this or the greatest that, unless it is. But this wasn't. This was exactly what I said it was and was not. And please, starting with my man Keyshawn Johnson, all you out there already trying to compare poor Ant-Man to the 23 to Jordan, please stop. His teams, Ant-Man's teams, are now 3-8 in the postseason. I don't need to tell you what Michael Jordan did in the postseason. So as we speak, Ant-Man is no closer to Jordan than he is to Antarctica. I'm sorry, Cam. I will not stop expressing my quote-unquote irrelevant opinions in public, including this one. I miss watching you play quarterback. All right, suffer me this. I got to get this off my chest and out of my psyche because I'm still losing sleep over it. This was last Thursday on Undisputed Live. Keyshawn, Michael Irvin. Michael's gone off on some great tangent. I don't remember exactly what it was, but suddenly he's saying that when he was a little kid, he sold a candy for money, sold it around the neighborhood. The candy was called Now and Laters. And I let him finish the story, and then I interrupted to say, Now and Laters. I don't know Now or Laters. Now and Laters, excuse me. What exactly were they? And Keyshawn looks at me, to use his line, like I had frogs on my face. You don't know Now and Laters? I don't. I just don't. Never heard of Now and Laters. Keyshawn says, well, maybe it was a ghetto candy, which I've later learned. Not. I'm sure it is and it isn't. It's everywhere but where I grew up. So I wait until the end of the show, glance at my phone. I got like four messages from Lil Wayne, who sent me reams of research material, background material on Now and Laters. And he is ridiculing me in his texts for not knowing Now and Laters. Pictures of them, stories about them, Now and Laters. And I'm like, I'm sorry, I don't know them. And Wayne is saying to me that I should be embarrassed not to know them and that He's sure, said one of his texts, that my Twitter is blowing up, obviously from people ridiculing me, scoffing, laughing at me for not knowing now and laters. Then I get home, and my wife, Ernestine, the second I walk in the door, says, you don't know now and laters? I don't. I really don't. She said, I know now and later. She grew up on Long Island, like middle classy, about halfway out on Long Island before she moved to New York when she was 18. We had now and laters. They were everywhere. Oh, really? Well, I don't know now and laters. I don't think I missed them at my 7-Eleven. So it's coming across like I grew up some palatial estate. No, I didn't. I grew up in sort of a lower middle class neighborhood in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. 2-bedroom, 1-bath. It's a pretty good hike to the Woolworths where they had lots of candy. And it was an even longer hike to the 7-Eleven where they had even more candy. So Ernestine's asked me, did you have Starburst? Yeah, I didn't really like them, but we had them. And I'm asking her back, you know, Sweet Tarts? Sure. I say, surely you know Milk Duds, right? Yeah. And everybody knows M&Ms. Yeah, okay. She said, but everybody had now and laters. I said, we did not have now and laters in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, not in my neighborhood. And I didn't exactly live in Nichols Hills, which was the upper crusty, oil-rich neighborhood in Oklahoma City, the neighborhood. No, I'm 2-bedroom, 1-bath. Not exactly ghetto, but it's not exactly palatial estate. I don't know how we missed now and laters. So now I'm going back and forth with Wayne. This is Thursday night. And I said, we didn't have them in Oklahoma. And he said, oh, that's crazy. He's texting me back. I'm in Oklahoma. I said, you're in Oklahoma? Why? He's in Tulsa, where he's going to play a gig on Friday night. No, I think he played one on Thursday and Friday, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe I'm right. Thursday night, he played a gig. Sent me a great picture of a silhouette. It's shot from the back of the stage. You can see the silhouette of him and all the faces in the crowd. Wayne says the Tulsa audience is right up at the top of his list, that he gets more great reaction in Tulsa than he does anywhere on the international circuit that he plays. So it's weird. And I'm texting him like, well, I guess in Oklahoma, because we didn't have teeth, you know, nobody has teeth in Oklahoma, that maybe they didn't send now and laters because we didn't have the teeth to eat now and laters. He got a kick out of that. But the truth is, I know all the candy bars, the Milky Ways and the Babe Ruths and the Honor, you know all the candy bars, the Almond Joys. I know all of them. I know all of them. I wasn't a big candy eater, but I liked them. I know Reese's Peanut Butter Cup. I know all that. I just don't know now and laters. I'm sorry, we did not have now and laters. And from what I'm told, I'm not sure I would have liked now and laters because it sounds like they're pretty hard to actually work through. What do you do? Suck on them for a while until finally they soften up enough that you can sort of crunch through them with your teeth? Hard to bite through? I don't know. Well, now I'm educated. Now I know about now and laters. And the truth is, I'm not ashamed that I did not know them because I've texted all my friends I grew up with in Oklahoma City. Did you know now and laters? No. My best friend from childhood, still my best friend to this day, Craig Humphreys, radio legend in Oklahoma City. Did you know now and laters? Never heard of them. Thank you, Craig. Okay. It is that time of year once again. I can't say it's my favorite time, but it's time for madness. It's upon us. March madness, which can lead to March sadness, March badness. I'm sure you've been feverishly awaiting my final four picks. I know you can't live without my picks because I know you have made your NCAA bracket picks, bracket racket, all you pool fools out there. And you can't wait to see just how wrong I can be. You know, I believe that every living soul above 3 years of age in the United States of America by now has made March Madness pool picks. And I believe that 95% of those pool entrants didn't watch a single second of a regular season college basketball game. That's what I believe. 95% didn't watch a second. That 95% has made their picks based on school colors or mascots, team nicknames, or because their moms, uncles, third cousins, half-brother went to Samford or Grand Canyon or Longwood or Duquesne. I predict that the winner of your office pool will be the man or the woman who right now cannot name a single player on any of their final four picks. Not a single player. As I always say, the more you know about college basketball, the worse you'll probably do on your pool picks. This Thursday and this Friday are the ultimate, can you believe, days in all of sports. Can you believe that 13 Samford upset 4 Kansas? Yes, I can. Not that I'm saying that's happening, but yes, I could believe that would happen. I believe every NCAA upset. I don't second guess any of them. This tournament is stocked from top to bottom with hundreds and hundreds of pretty good basketball players, any one of whom can suddenly have their one shining moment in their life and get crazy hot from three when you and he least expect it. Gone are the days of the Kareem Abdul-Jabbar or the Bill Walton or the Magic Johnson just dominating the NCAA tournament the way they're about to dominate the NBA. John Calipari, coach at Kentucky, obviously, has won one national championship with Anthony Davis. This year's Kentucky has two players that are ranked top 12-ish in the NBA mock drafts that I've checked out. Two players. And Kentucky is a 3 seed. So, the best teams in this tournament are forced to play on these 2 days, especially in strange gymnasiums, weird times, very early, very late, with extremely amateurish college referees. Games barely last 2 hours. They're over before you know it. Players only get 5 fouls, and invariably the best players are in early foul trouble. And that 3-point line is significantly, outrageously closer than the NBA's. So buzzer beaters will be buzzing like swarms of bees on Red Bull. Bees on Red Bull. They'll be everywhere. Can you believe it? Yes, I can. So I've held you in suspense long enough. Drum roll, please. Maybe jelly roll. That's probably what my picks are worth, a jelly roll. My final four picks are St. Mary's, Purdue, Iowa State, and Houston. And I have Iowa State and Houston meeting for the first all Big 12 championship game since Oklahoma got shocked by Danny and the Miracles, Danny Manning's Kansas, as I believe they were an 8 seed in 1988, Kansas City. I was there. Yep, I grew up in Big 12 country. And yes, I grew up an Oklahoma fan. But I do believe that Iowa State, from what I've seen, I've watched them 4 or 5 times. I believe that the Cyclones are just the kind of starless, egoless, defense-first, beautifully coached team, highly capable of upsetting defending champ UConn in the regional final. Most experts that I hear, see, read, they're going with the top dog, the top seed, UConn. Mostly, I believe, because they don't want to get shamed on social media when their picks are wrong. At least if UConn does get upset, they can say, well, they were the top seed. But I believe Iowa State will lose the national championship game to Houston, which is actually just a little better Iowa State. Same team, this one coached by, I think, the best coach remaining in college basketball, Kelvin Sampson. I know he's had his issues, but that man can flat coach both ends of the floor, defense first and offense. So why, you ask, St. Mary's? The Gales are in by far the weakest to me regional. They haven't lost since Christmas. I watched them handle Gonzaga, which is still pretty good. I just like their mental and physical toughness, St. Mary's. They play the right way. They have veteran toughness to them. They have a legacy there of Euro players on their way to the NBA. By the way, the WCC Player of the Year this year, Augustus Marshallonis, son of Sharunas Marshallonis, used to be one of my favorite players when he played for Golden State, so maybe I'm rooting for the son to play like the father. A lot of experts that I see have a 12 beating a 5, Grand Canyon upsetting St. Mary's. I don't see it. Could happen, but I don't see it. And by the way, I went with Purdue, a 1 seed, a year ago, lost to a 16 seed. That was the second time that's ever happened. That was Fairleigh Dickinson. Of course, Virginia lost to UNBC. That was the first ever. And then Virginia bounced back the next year and won the national championship. So I like Purdue bouncing back from their nightmare of a year ago to at least get to the Final Four. So that's it. St. Mary's, Purdue, Iowa State, Houston. Laugh if you want. Crazy as though it may seem. I like my Final Four picks. And for all I know, half of them will be gone by Monday. Now, a quick postscript to this that should have been my lead to this topic. I'll be the first to tell you, I'm even more interested in this year's women's NCAA tournament than I am the men's. I'll watch the men's like crazy. As crazy as I think it is, I will watch like crazy. But I'm captivated watching Caitlin Clark. I don't think Iowa is great. She is, but they aren't. But I'm still in awe of what the NCAA did to her and to the Hawkeyes. Handicapping them into the by far toughest regional, by far the tough. This is the death regional. This is murderer's row. So now Iowa's path is going to be, if the seeds hold, they're going to have to deal with Kansas State. They played Kansas State twice. Kansas State beat them at Iowa, 65-58. Then they got some revenge, 77-70 on a neutral site floor. But they got to deal with Kansas State early. And then to get to the Final Four, they're either going to have to deal with LSU, who waxed them last year in the national championship game. Angel Reese and LSU is a 3 seed. And somebody's going to come out of LSU-UCLA, which went 25-6 in by far the strongest conference this year, the Pac-12. Lord have mercy. So you're going to have to play the winner of Angel Reese and UCLA just to get to Cleveland in the Final Four. That's just not fair. And then at the Final Four, you're going to have to deal with, if you're Iowa and Caitlin Clark, 2 USCs. One of them is the University of Southern California. And the other is the University of South Carolina, which is easily the best team in the country. So you're going to have to deal with both, bang, bang. And if somehow Caitlin Clark leads Iowa to this national championship, she will have earned every last step. This is Jed from Corvallis, Oregon, who asks, is there anything about the Cowboys you're excited about? That's an interesting question, Jed, because I've made it very clear that they finally lost me. Been a fan since I was 10 years of age, but they lost me when they didn't just lose to Green Bay in that playoff game. They got all-time embarrassed. They weren't even competitive. It was 27-0 before halftime. It was 48-16 early in the fourth quarter. This was at home at Jerry World as the 2 seed against a 7 seed that was the youngest team in all of pro football. And that happened. It's inexcusable. It's unacceptable. It's unconscionable. And I still have not recovered. So every morning, right here in this building where I sit, Fox lot at FS1, I walk in the door of the lobby. The overnight security guard, Derek, is there. He's a huge Cowboy fan. Everybody's a Cowboy fan. Everywhere you go out here in L.A., heck, everywhere I used to go in New York, they're Cowboy fans. They're all trapped, having to deal with Jerry Jones as our owner and operator over 30 lean years in which we haven't even sniffed an NFC championship game. And Derek tries to get his heart back into it. What do you think about free agent? Is there still somebody out there we could, is there a running back? Is there maybe a receiver we could, is there this? Derek's trying to get back in the flow of things because that's just what fans do. What do you think about the draft? Should they go offensive line first and maybe running back second round? And I try to get into it, get my heart back into it. But then Jed asks, is there anything I still like? Well, there are 2 things I still do love about this team. This is interesting to me because this week we've had Paul Pierce back on Undisputed. Paul obviously played basketball, not football. But we got into a deep discussion during a break about, okay, who are the killers left in pro basketball in the NBA? I'm talking about cold-blooded assassins in the basketball context. You can say that dog, you got that dog in you, but I'm talking about even beyond that dog in you. I'm talking about push comes to shove, game on the line, cold-blooded killer. Paul immediately brought up Kawhi. I agree. He is. He's that. Whatever chance the Clippers have, I still think they'll be hamstrung by James Harden, Russell Westbrook. But whatever chance they have, it's how far Kawhi and his killer instinct can carry them. And Paul brought up Giannis. Giannis has earned Paul's respect as a killer. I'll buy that. I will buy that. He has turned into that. After that, we're looking at today's kids, and we think, well, Anthony Edwards could be. You see early signs, but we need to see him in high-stress playoff situations. But now I'm back to the Cowboys. What do I like? What am I still excited about? CeeDee Lamb is a cold-blooded killer to me. He's that guy. He's that dude. He's got all of that dog in him. He's a football player. He doesn't talk big, doesn't act big, no big diva act. I was just dumbfounded when Dak actually got into it with CD as they left the field after the first series in that Green Bay playoff game. Dak started it. You can just see CD throw up his hands. Dak's on him for running some, you know, nuanced wrong route. It was 3rd and 8. They didn't connect. See, he went over and sat on the bench by himself, shaking his head. It took Mike McCarthy leaving his perch as the play caller. Obviously, they're on defense at this point, but walking all the way over to sort of talk CD off the ledge. He's that guy on that team. I wish he were more vocal because he could become the leader, the Michael Irvin wearing 88 of that football team. And I'm also still excited about the young tight end, Jake Ferguson. I did not see him coming. They lost Dalton Schultz, and I thought, man, that's a hole, maybe not a gaping hole, but a hole nonetheless, because Dalton Schultz was a pretty good security blanket for Dak Prescott. Jake Ferguson's got that dog in him. They need to feature Jake more. Every time he caught the football, he turned and ran with Ant-Man kind of rage. It's hard to get him on the ground. Whatever burns inside of him, I wish I could pour inside about 6 or 8 other Cowboys I will not name. But those two players, CD and Jake Ferguson, still excite me. Which leads me to the next question from Jackson from Hollywood, Florida. Do you think Jerry is waiting for the draft to make a big trade? I'm sorry, Jackson, when I read your question, I chuckled painfully. I don't know what you're talking about exactly. You mean a draft day trade, as in trade up in the draft? To get exactly what? Jerry doesn't trade up. Jerry trades back. Jerry and Steven are always trying to be the two smartest guys in the room. They're always looking around with their noses in the air. We don't do free agency. You guys go out there on day one and day two and overpay for these free agents. You guys go out there and trade up for these quarterbacks and trade up and blow your draft capital and overdraft these kids. We sit back. We sit here and we do it the right way. This is Jerry and Steven's attitude. Drives me out of my mind. Snooty, nose in air. We draft Pro Bowl players. We develop our own and we keep our own, except for Tyron Smith, who just left for the Jets. Has 2 Hall of Fame years left in his body. I know he's not always available, but when he's right, he's the rightest. Jets gave him up to $20 million with incentives. Nope, we didn't keep our own in that case. But my Cowboys doing it the right way, drafting our own, developing our own, keeping our own. All those Pro Bowl players have got us what? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. I told you last week, and I'm going to say it again, over the last 30 years, 20 teams have played at least 15 playoff games, and of those 20, the Dallas Cowboys have the worst playoff record. We've played 18 games over the last 30 years in the postseason. We're 5-13. That percentage-wise is the worst record of those 20 teams who have played at least 15 playoff games. That is just so wrong. If Jerry Jones were just a GM and not the owner, he would have been fired 20 times. He would have been long, long gone. We sit back and do it right. We're built to last. What is built to last? What can I love about being down 27 to nothing at home before halftime of your first playoff game as the two seed with the chance to have Detroit at home the next week and then maybe go to San Francisco in an NFC championship game and right the wrong of losing to them painfully in the previous two playoff runs? 27 to nothing? No NFC championship game and going on 30 years? 5-13? We don't trade up, Jackson. Now we're relegated because we have so many gaping holes. Trust me on this. They'll sit there at 23 in the first round, 23rd overall pick, and they'll have to take an offensive lineman. Whoever's left on the board, they're going to have to take that offensive lineman, and they're going to have to plug that lineman in at either left tackle or left guard and say play. Plug and play a rookie. And then in the second round, I'm assuming they'll take a running back. And that running back is going to have to be plugged and played as a rookie as the starting running back. And then maybe in the third round, they draft the best center left on the board as an offensive line center. And that center will have to be plugged and played as a raw rookie in place of Tyler Biadasz, who is now a Washington Commander. I am telling you, this team is in grave danger of missing the playoffs next year. There is no way this team can be as good as it was even last year when it got blown out at San Francisco in the regular season. It lost at Arizona badly in the regular season. It got blown out at Buffalo, run off the field in the regular season. And then that happened in the postseason. This is Kyle from Burbank, as in California. What sporting event were you the most nervous about before it started? That's a very good question. And I've thought hard about this, Kyle. I hark back to the three Super Bowls way, way back when that I obviously covered, experienced up close and personal to the 1990s with my Dallas Cowboys, the dynastic Jimmy Cowboys. I had two books hanging fire on two of those three Super Bowls. The first one, well, really, it was it wasn't the first one. It was the second one, book I wrote called The Boys, off the outcome of that Super Bowl, and they won it. I'm sorry, that would have been the first Super Bowl, yes, that they broke through and won and after the 92 season. And then my third Cowboy book was off the 95 season, and they broke through and won that. But before those Super Bowls, I wasn't nervous at all because I just knew they were going to win. They were just that dominant. I had no second guesses, no mixed emotions whatsoever. Then I fast forward to my Spurs that I loved and LeBron's Heat, those back-to-back finals, game 6 in Miami, the legendary Ray Allen game when he shot me right in the heart and saved LeBron's legacy, which led to game 7, which I just knew they were going to lose, my Spurs. I don't know. I just thought they were better than the Miami Heat. I had no trepidation about game 6. All they had to do was win it and celebrate, and they did everything but. And then the following year in 2014, they split the first two games in San Antonio, games 3 and 4. I guess I had some trepidation about in Miami, but LeBron just disappeared in both games, and it became a gentleman's sweep by the biggest margin in NBA Finals history. So no, it wasn't that. You ready for this? I got it. The sporting event before which I was the most nervous was Conor McGregor versus Floyd Mayweather. I don't even know what you call it. I guess it was a boxing match. Those were the rules. Moments before that, I just watched on pay-per-view here in LA. I was so nervous. I was actually having a hard time with my breathing. And I'm like, what are you doing? It was just such a rare matchup of MMA versus legendary greatest defensive fighter ever. And I really thought Conor had a chance to get him because Conor could strike. Conor could punch. Conor was so much longer than Floyd. And that left hand of Conor's was lethal. I really thought Conor would get him. We had Floyd's father on out here in LA in studio, and he and I got into it, and then he bet me on live TV $1,000. He called it for a suit of clothes. And I took the bet because I got pride. Maybe I don't have sense, but I got pride. So I got $1,000 riding on it. I can't expense it here at Fox. That's out of my pocket. And I wound up having to pay it. And I did. But I will go to my grave saying, Conor had Floyd in trouble in the 10th round. In the corner, he had him in trouble. And that referee, Robert Byrd, Birdman, I thought he saved Floyd. He broke it up, made him start over and touch gloves out in the middle of the ring. He saved him. News this week, Conor McGregor says he'll come back to the Octagon sometime this summer. There's reports of June 29th. I'll watch, but I don't care anymore. The last of Conor was that night against Floyd. Conor got $100 million to lose to Floyd Mayweather Jr., and he was never, ever the same. Now he's becoming a movie star. Roadhouse is coming out soon. I can't wait. He's big. He says that there are discussions of him becoming a franchise a la Stallone or Schwarzenegger. I wouldn't be surprised. He's got a huge personality. So that night was the last of Conor McGregor. And that night, I thought he hung in. I thought he had Floyd in trouble. But that night, before that started, I had no real idea of what was about to transpire, and I have never been remotely as nervous. Final question is from Carl from Glendale, California. Did you run the LA Marathon? This was last Sunday here in Los Angeles. No, Carl, I did not. And no, I will not run any more marathons. I ran 9. Last one just after I turned 40. My problem, Carl, is I'm too vain and I'm too competitive to run any more marathons. Marathons just took too much out of me and out of my body. For my best marathons, I weighed 145-ish. I now hold my weight at 165. I lift a lot of weight. I like the way I look. I'm vain. I admit it. You got me. But when I ran marathons, I ran for time, not to finish. I ran for time, for what they call PRs, as in personal records. I ran 9 marathons, and I never walked 1 second of any marathon. I did 5 of them under 3 hours, and 4 of them just over 3 hours, with a worst time of 309. I had one great one because they say you only have one great one in your body. Mine was my second one ever. This was in 1985 at the Woodlands, Houston, Texas, on a rainy 55-degree day, perfect for running 26.2 miles. I weighed 145 pounds for that one. It finished on the track at the high school in the middle of the Woodlands. I think it's called Woodlands High School, I'm not sure. But we finished on the quarter-mile track, and I felt like I could have run 10 more miles. That's how beautiful that experience was. I ran 2 hours and 47 minutes and 11 seconds. That was 6 minutes and 22 seconds per mile. Right now, I can't fathom doing that, and I don't know how I did it that day, but I did. I've always said marathons were dear to me because, to me, as weird as this might sound, it's actually the closest a man can come to giving birth. I don't even have any kids, but this is just what always occurred to me, that it felt like, weirdly, you give birth because it takes 9 good months, hard months, to get ready for a marathon. And then all of a sudden it happens, and it's grueling and it's painful, and you think you'll never finish. And then there it is. Closest a man can come to the greatest thing on earth, which is giving birth. I had so many impossibly unpredictable experiences in my marathons. Everyone was a completely different story of this injury or that. I ran New York Marathon. Start off across the Verrazano Narrows Bridge, coming out of Staten Island into Brooklyn. I barely got across the bridge, and my IT band pulled. If you know, the IT band runs down your side, attaches at your knee, iliotibial band. It just pulled. It went crazy. It was killing me. I couldn't stride out anymore. You want to talk about long 3 hours. I thought it would never end. Even my first marathon was in San Francisco, and I wore the wrong shoes. I tried to run in racing flats with no protection whatsoever, no insole. Nearly destroyed my feet. I thought I had stress fractures in both feet. I had to get them x-rayed. They weren't fractured, but they felt like it. I could barely walk for a week after that. Every marathon had a different story. Everyone is still very special to me, but I'm not capable of experiencing getting ready for that again because I don't want to lose 20 pounds to get ready for it. I like the way I look. But this past Sunday, my wife Ernestine and I live in a gated community here on the west side of LA. We were locked in by the marathon. We could not leave our gated community because everything in our community got shut down by the marathon. Ernestine goes crazy every year. This is ridiculous. We can't even walk out of our gate because there are so many people flooding by, runners and gawkers. It ends at a mall not far from where we live. Everything shut down for all morning and most of the afternoon. Ernestine went crazy, said they should ban these marathons. I said, well, you lived in New York. Should they ban the New York Marathon? Yes. It just completely screws up all day on that Sunday. No, I said, I'm very happy to be inconvenienced because I know what that day meant. What special things happened to the psyches of many of those participants in the LA Marathon. I miss it, but I'll never do it again. For me, it's just too hard. That's it for episode 105. Thank you for listening and or watching. Thanks to Jonathan Berger and his All-Pro team for making this show go. Thanks to Tyler Korn for producing. Please remember, Undisputed, every weekday, 9:30 to noon Eastern Time, The Skip Bayless Show, every week.